Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. A critical vote. Under increasing scrutiny, we examine the president's claims about mail-in ballots and what we need to know. Then, underwater, how the storm named Sally has created devastating floods across the Southeast. And cost of a vaccine. We dig into the economics behind the push to combat COVID-19.
There should be no reason that pharma companies should be having exclusive licenses to charge whatever they want.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. With less than 7 weeks until Election Day, the question of how Americans will vote has grown even more contentious. The security of elections and mail-in ballots was once again at the top of mind for many officials in Washington today. Our William Brangham begins our coverage.
The day started with another inaccurate tweet from President Trump about mail-in voting. The president has repeatedly made false statements about who is being sent mail-in ballots and what mail-in voting could mean for the election. Today, he asserted falsely that, quote, the November 3rd election result may never be accurately determined, unquote. On Capitol Hill today, FBI Director Christopher Wray told Congress that proven election meddling is coming from Russia. The Russians aren't targeting election infrastructure, Wray said, but stirring up division.
Well, we certainly have seen very active efforts by the Russians to influence our election in 2020 through what I would call more the malign foreign influence side of things. Social media, use of proxies, state media, online journals, et cetera, an effort to both sow divisiveness and discord. And I think the intelligence community has assessed this publicly, to denigrate Vice President Biden.
Wray's testimony comes a week after a Department of Homeland Security whistleblower alleged he was told to tamp down intelligence relating to Russian interference. But last night, President Trump downplayed the risk of foreign influence, instead saying, again, with no evidence behind his statement, the Democratic governors mailing out ballots would be the gravest threat come November.
Our biggest threat to this election is governors from opposing parties controlling ballots, millions of ballots. To me, that's a much bigger threat than foreign countries, because much of the stuff coming out about foreign countries turned out to be untrue.
Today, in an op-ed in the New York Times, President Trump's former hand-picked Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, warned of the stakes, writing, "The most urgent task American leaders face is to ensure that the election's results are accepted as legitimate. Electoral legitimacy is the essential linchpin of our entire political culture." Coates went on to offer a potential solution, calling on Congress to create a bipartisan and nonpartisan commission to oversee the election. He said the key goal should be reassuring the American people that their votes will count. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
There were two court rulings today bearing on all of this. A federal judge in Washington state issued a nationwide injunction against Postal Service changes that have slowed mail service. He ruled that voters could be disenfranchised. And the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court ordered that deadlines for mail-in voting be eased and that more ballot collection sites be set up. Now, the second major story, the aftermath of Hurricane Sally. The storm moved east and kept dumping rain today. In its wake, heavy flooding along the Gulf Coast kept rescuers busy, while others began the cleanup. John Yang has our report.
It's been mighty bad, and our state is reeling just as our people are hurting.
Hundreds of thousands of people across the Gulf Coast were without power this morning in the aftermath of Hurricane Sally. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey called for patience as her state recovers.
Y'all, I know it's uncomfortable and downright scary to be sitting in the darkness of your home without any lights. But please, be patient.
Alabama has seen at least one fatality. The mayor of Orange Beach said one person died there and another is missing as the small coastal city grapples with continued floods. Overnight, the storm weakened from a Category 2 hurricane to a tropical depression, but heavy rains continue to pound Gulf Coast communities like Pensacola, Florida, where bloated waters reduced boat docks to driftwood. In Perdido Key, residents like this business owner are picking up the pieces of buildings destroyed by Sally's 100-mile-plus winds. Those winds also toppled the spire at this Mobile, Alabama church. The trail of destruction has some coastal residents reflecting on the places they call home. Rocky Bond of Pascagoula, Mississippi, calls his boat on the Singing River a piece of paradise, but a risky one.
Water comes up and it takes the wood and the beams and it lifts the whole thing up and it pulls the pilings out of the ground. So just hurricane living in this area to enjoy this kind of paradise, there's a price to pay.
Sally's slow pace as it moves north is also putting swaths of the southeast under flash and coastal flood warnings. Today, thick rain clouds hovered over downtown Atlanta as Sally barreled through Georgia with up to 2 inches of rainfall. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
In the day's other news, new unemployment claims fell to 860,000 last week, but job layoffs from the pandemic remained at historic highs. Meanwhile, airline executives were at the White House warning that they may have to cut 40,000 jobs next month unless Congress can pass a new relief bill. The World Health Organization warned today against letting politics affect pandemic policy. That came after President Trump publicly criticized Dr. Robert Redfield, the head of the CDC, for his statements on masks and vaccines. Meanwhile, Olivia Troy, who's a former aide to Vice President Pence, who played a central role in the White House coronavirus task force, said that she is voting for Joe Biden because the president placed re-election ahead of saving human lives. We'll return to pandemic politics after the news summary. New York City has again postponed in-person schooling for more than 1 million students. Mayor Bill de Blasio announced today that most elementary school students will return to the classroom on September 29th. Middle and high schoolers will start October 1st. De Blasio said that schools need more time.
We have to have social distancing throughout schools, cleaning constantly, face coverings on students and adults alike, a host of measures that had to be put in place all system-wide. We're continuing to deepen those efforts because we have to meet that gold standard for the good of all in our school community.
The city's schools are still wrestling with shortages of staff and supplies. Smoke over parts of the fire-ravaged West Coast cleared some today for the first time in days. Still, air quality over Portland, Oregon, and other cities remained at hazardous levels. Fire crews hope that scattered rain expected this weekend will help douse more of the fires and dissipate the smoke. The head of the FBI says that its agents are focused on violent extremism and not ideology in nationwide protests over racial injustice. Director Christopher Wray testified at a congressional hearing today. It followed reports that a federal crackdown on violence during protests has netted more than 300 arrests. And on Wall Street, stocks gave ground on concerns about the economy and doubts that Congress will pass more pandemic aid. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 130 points to close at 27,902. The Nasdaq fell 140 points, and the S&P 500 slipped 28. Still to come on the NewsHour, the economics behind the race for a COVID vaccine, Bob Woodward on his explosive new book on the president, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
the president is again contradicting some of his own top health officials about the timing of a vaccine and the effectiveness of masks. Yesterday, as we said, CDC Director Robert Redfield told a Senate committee that he believed a vaccine would not be widely available to most Americans before the middle of next year. People at higher risk or medical workers or first responders are likely to get it sooner. But he said greater mask use was the most essential way to protect Americans.
I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine, because the immunogenicity may be 70%. And if I don't get an immune response, the vaccine's not going to protect me. This face mask will.
Hours later, the president rejected what Redfield and other scientists have said. He insisted that 100 million doses of vaccines would be widely distributed before the end of this year. But today, the head of Moderna, which is a vaccine manufacturer, said that his company would likely not distribute its vaccine widely before next summer. President Trump also downplayed the use of masks once again and disputed Redfield.
I think he made a mistake when he said that. It's just incorrect information. I mean, I think there's a lot of problems with masks. No, vaccine is much more effective than the masks. But no, the mask is not as important as the vaccine. The mask perhaps helps.
All of this comes as the CDC announced that it expects to distribute vaccines to the public at no out-of-pocket cost to the patient. But there are significant questions and criticisms about what the government's doing to pay for vaccines with taxpayer money and whether companies should be able to profit from it. Economics correspondent Paul Solman dives into the part of the story for our series, Making Sense.
A newsreel from 1955 on the polio vaccine.
An historic victory over a dread disease.
The vaccine's inventor, Dr. Jonas Salk, literally gave it away.
Who owns the patent on this vaccine?
The people, I would say. There is no patent. This is... Could you patent the sun?
Pandemia è una crisi.
65 years later, Pope Francis thinks the COVID-19 vaccine should follow the polio precedent.
It would be a scandal if our economic system, supported by public funds, contributes only to companies instead of the common good.
No question, public funds are driving the huge COVID vaccine effort.
It's called Operation Warp Speed. That means big and it means fast.
But looming over Operation Warp Speed is a huge question. How much is the public, through the government, paying private companies?
There is no reason that private pharmaceutical companies should be profiteering off of a pandemic.
Osorame Okolo is the chief health policy aide for Illinois Democrat Jan Schakowsky.
Yes or no? Will you sell your vaccine at cost so that we can verify you aren't making a profit?
Merck's vaccine has received $38 million in government funding. Julie Gerberding is executive vice president.
No, we will not be selling vaccine at cost, although it's very premature for us since we're a long way from really understanding the cost basis of what will end up.
So, Dr. Hoag, yes or no?
Stephen Hoag is president of Moderna, which by some measures has gotten nearly $1.5 billion in federal funding, all the money it's put into the vaccine, and will get another $1.5 billion if it succeeds.
We will not sell it at cost, no, ma'am.
Which is why health policy wonks like Okolo are up in arms.
There should be no reason that pharma companies should be having exclusive licenses to charge whatever they want, to control distribution of these drugs, to control the price and access not only in the United States, but across the world.
Charge whatever they want to a U.S. government desperate for a vaccine, any vaccine, running a tab that we taxpayers will ultimately pick up.
I have an incurable blood cancer called multiple myeloma.
Longtime public health advocate David Mitchell is founder of Patients for Affordable Drugs.
My doctors have me on a four-drug combination that carries a list price of $900,000 a year. So I care deeply about vaccines that will be affordable, because if you have a blood cancer and if you're taking chemotherapy, both of which I am, then the risk of a very bad outcome from COVID-19 is high. So I want a vaccine real bad.
But if it's a vaccine we already subsidized, Is the government, and therefore we taxpayers, really going to have to pay again?
The White House says that we've pumped $12 billion to these drug companies for Operation Warp Speed. We are effectively underwriting R&D, clinical trials, standing up production capability, and even producing, paying to produce the drugs.
Just consider Moderna's contract, $3 billion to immunize 50 million Americans.
Not to personalize this too much, but I have paid $10 for every member of my family already to develop the Moderna vaccine, and so has every other American, right?
That's correct, but only about one in six Americans would get those initial doses.
Peter Mabarduke of the Ralph Nader nonprofit Public Citizen.
How much is it going to cost for every American to get immunized?
It'd be about $10 billion total U.S. government investment. The U.S. government has options to purchase hundreds of millions of more doses from Moderna, up to 250 million people.
So that's something like $40 from the U.S. government to Moderna for every American who gets immunized. Doesn't sound so bad.
But that's not really the point here. The U.S. government appears to co-own this vaccine. It can insist on reasonable pricing and conditions. And if you look at comparable vaccines, AstraZeneca will charge no more than $8 per person. The price really could be quite a bit lower.
But who knows for how long these prices will hold when the pandemic ends? And we might still need an annual COVID shot that we might have to pay for out of pocket.
We are really over a barrel if these kind of guarantees aren't written into the initial contracts.
And thus the simple question, says health journalist Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal.
Why are we paying for something that the government itself largely developed? Government institutions created the platforms for many of these new, really innovative vaccines. And we are now paying through BARDA, through the Defense Department program, to ramp up production, manufacturing, distribution. So haven't we paid already?
And as a result, in the case of Moderna, enriching its private investors by public investment that has literally tripled the company's stock value? Okay, sure, drug companies will profit, but, and this is where the argument changes direction, why is that a problem?
You want vaccines to be somewhat profitable because you want manufacturers to be incented to make them.
Stock analyst Evan Seigerman puts the time-honored case for profits succinctly.
But it is important that they are allowed to make some sort of a profit so that they will continue to invest in research and development, in manufacturing, and of course, distribution.
We can treat viruses, the scourge of humanity.
Look, the stakes are life and death, says Adam Mossoff, a free market enthusiast at George Mason University. The companies need profits, he says.
If they're going to continue doing more R&D into new drugs and new medical treatments that have made modern life a veritable miracle by any historical standards. I mean, what were just death sentences 10, 20 years ago, cancer, diabetes, hepatitis, are now manageable day-to-day conditions thanks to the types of investments and the thousands, millions of labor hours put in by researchers and scientists in the biopharmaceutical industry.
But our skeptics don't buy the profit motive story.
Some of the money we spend is plowed back into development, and that's hugely useful. But also, we should look at what pharmaceutical companies are spending for marketing, for promotion.
Which for the 10 largest U.S.-based prescription drug companies is actually almost as much as R&D spending. Add in profits, and it's far more.
I joke that it used to be that a Nobel Prize was motivation enough, but all of our drug makers are now publicly traded, mostly, or privately owned for-profit companies. So that's where we are.
But to health economist Catherine Baker, where we are with regard to COVID vaccine pricing is okay, even with the huge government subsidies, at least for now.
I don't think we can count on the government to be responsible for all of the refinement that we need for all medicines, because it just requires a lot of ingenuity, and the incentives that we have in the private market are what drives a lot of innovation.
And invites a lot of competition.
You want people to be encouraged to make vaccines. If you have more than one manufacturer, the price is likely to go down.
Remember, says Baker,
these vaccines are worth trillions of dollars to the world. There's so much value to be created that there's room for there to be economic gain to the people who invested in the medicine, whether that's private sector or public, as well as much greater benefits to the public in the form of improved health and resumed economic activity.
As long as people take it, and it doesn't become prohibitively expensive down the line. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman.
We turn now to the political fallout facing President Trump amid new reporting from veteran journalist Bob Woodward of The Washington Post. Woodward's newest book, Rage, features 18 on-the-record interviews and recordings of President Trump, ranging from his handling of the coronavirus to racial injustice. And Bob Woodward joins me now. And Bob Woodward, congratulations on this book. This is a president about whom so much has been written. What of all the time you spent with him do you think adds the most to our understanding of who Donald Trump is?
Well, it is a look into his mind. I asked him, what's the job of the president? He said, to protect the people. He failed in that, and he failed to tell the truth, tragically.
So these dire warnings that were given to him in January, he knew this. You cite Tony Fauci saying he had a minus number attention span. You also write at length about Robert Redfield, the head of the Centers for Disease Control, who's back in the news right now because he is urging Americans to wear a mask. He is urging caution about a vaccine. The president is contradicting him. Take us to the essence of that relationship.
Redfield heads the overall CDC, which is responsible for tracking down the cause of some sort of health crisis. He realized that this could be some sort of pandemic. In fact, he told associates, and this is the key, he said, this is not going to be something that goes away or is dealt with in 6 months or a year. It is going to be a 2 or 3 year fight. We now realize that that's exactly the situation, and that's exactly what President Trump knew and did not tell us.
And is continuing to push back against even today. Bob Woodward, the United States has just 4% of the world's population, and yet the United States has almost a quarter of all the COVID cases in the world. We have by far more deaths than any other country on the planet. And yet, in essence, President Trump is telling you he's done a masterful job of managing it. Does he believe that? Has he convinced himself of that? Or does the truth matter?
Well, I'm not sure that truth matters. And I pushed him on this just as much as you possibly can. And he actually said in public, he said, there are things I said that are just great. And I let him have his say because he deserves that. But I also press him on these issues, particularly the virus. 195,000 people have died from this on his watch.
So much to ask you about so many revelations conversations here. At one point, the then director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, says he continued to harbor this belief that it continued to grow, that he never could find proof, but he believed somehow that Russia's Vladimir Putin had something on the president. Is that something that is still an open question in your mind?
Well, it was in Dan Coats' mind. He had access to all the deep cover human sources, all the communications intercepts, absolutely everything on this, and he sorted through it meticulously with his aides, and because he felt, because of the way the president responds to Putin, that it looked like Putin had something on Trump. Coates did not find evidence or proof of this, but he continued to harbor the absolute conviction that Putin did have something on Trump.
You also have, you quote James Mattis as saying the president doesn't know the difference between the truth and a lie. You have Dan Coats, again, former director of national intelligence, saying the president was played skillfully by people like Putin, China's leader Xi Jinping. He said because they lied to him. You quote the former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson saying he was unstable. Why do you think they won't say it themselves?
Well, I had the luxury of time, 10 months to work on this, ask Trump all kinds of questions, ask other people. I have sources in the White House, the CIA, the Pentagon, the State Department, who will tell me what's going on. And all of the quotations from these officials are reported in depth and I am confident are absolutely true.
Another issue that is huge before the American people this year, Bob Woodward, of course, after the death of George Floyd, is the reckoning over race. And you did talk to the president at several points about his view of race. You asked him if he believed there's systematic racism in this country. He said there's less than in most other countries, than in many other countries. What did you conclude about his view when it comes to racism?
Well, I pushed him on that, and I said, what about this country? And he acknowledged, said, yes, there is, more or less, I'm sorry to say there is. But more importantly, I flat out asked him, I said, look, you are the son of white privilege. My father was a judge in Illinois, a lawyer, and I know I had this white privilege, and I asked Trump, so in a sense we're living in a cave, we're isolated, and do you understand, Mr. President, the pain and anger that black people feel? And this tape has been released in which the president mocks me, essentially says, wow, you really drank the Kool-Aid, Bob. I don't feel that way at all. So he rejects just openly this idea that black people can feel this pain. And I said to the president, that's your job. You've got to understand people. You've got to get in other people's shoes. And he said, well, he likes to be in his own shoes. And this is part of the calamity of this presidency, that the leader won't listen, the leader will not organize. I literally said to him, you need a Manhattan Project, like Franklin Roosevelt launched during World War II to build the atomic bomb. And where's the Manhattan Project? Where's full mobilization? And he failed to do that, and it's one of the saddest, most disturbing chapters in American history, as best I can tell.
Do you think he cares about the American people?
Well, I think he's not heartless. I think he's driven toward re-election, and I don't know his motive, but his motive is clearly re-election.
Last question. You mentioned law and order. As you know, there are Democrats, there are conservative Republicans, never Trumper Republicans, who are now saying they are concerned that this president has no respect for norms, for the rule of law, and they are seriously worried that he will not accept the results of the election, that he may do anything. They don't know what he would do in the last 6 weeks of this election in order to win. Do you have that sense?
Well, I asked him about that, and he said he wouldn't comment. But it's not I think it's a mistake to kind of look and say, oh, he's broken norms, he's different. Of course he's different. He was elected to be different. We shouldn't be surprised at that at all. And my judgment at the end that he's the wrong man for the job is not a political judgment at all. It's based on overwhelming evidence and the utter sadness I feel in doing this reporting and spending all this time with him and the key people in the administration, that he has failed. And the failure, it doesn't end. We are on a moving train with this virus, and all the people who know the most about it say in the coming months it's going to converge with the flu, and we are going to have a hailstorm and a hurricane all at once.
Bob Woodward, thank you. The book is Rage. We appreciate it. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo left this morning for South America to consult with allies and to press the case against the Maduro government of Venezuela, which has ruled over economic and societal collapse. And that was before COVID-19. Special correspondent Marcia Biggs went to Venezuela earlier this year for us and has this update on a country in crisis, now stricken with the pandemic.
This is what it looked like in Venezuela's public hospitals before the pandemic. Overrun, a shortage of doctors and drugs, no electricity or even running water. We were there just 7 months ago, filming with hidden cameras to document a public health care system coming apart at the seams. And that was before COVID-19.
How much worse has it gotten?
I mean, it's the worst case scenario. I mean, we are in the perfect storm. We came from a very deep health crisis, and now we're in the middle of that with an epidemic, which is, I mean, it's a worldwide epidemic. Doctors are dying.
Dr. Julio Castro is an advisor to Venezuela's opposition-led National Assembly, and because of his position, was willing to talk to us.
Actually, right now, the occupancy of ICU in Venezuela is close to 50%. But with those 50%, the ICU are totally collapsed because they don't have medical supply.
We spoke with a 27-year-old medical resident who we'll call Maria. She works in one of Caracas' public hospitals and is too scared to show her face.
Patients die every day. The problem is that the patients arrive in such bad condition that we can't even do the test. After my last three shifts ended, I started to cry because of what I couldn't do, because of how limited I was, because I wasn't able to help. The demand is too high. It's more than we can handle.
She says she fears retaliation in a country where criticism of the government's handling of the pandemic is grounds for arrest. Venezuela has been on a strict lockdown since March. Banks are closed, schools and shops are empty, and travel around the capital, Caracas, requires military permission. A recent report by Human Rights Watch details the use of COVID-19 by the Maduro regime as an excuse to crack down on dissenting voices of lawyers, journalists, and healthcare workers. This video shows people being forced into hard labor for not wearing masks. And children forced to do push-ups for being out in the streets.
Actually, the regime has been telling to the people that they are in control of the pandemic, which is not true.
Simplemente quedémonos en casa.
The Maduro regime claims to have performed almost 2 million COVID tests, but it's unclear whether that number refers to the rapid test or the more reliable PCR test, which is performed with a nasal swab. The government's figures put the country's total coronavirus cases at over 60,000, with nearly 500 dead. But there is no independent tally, and Dr. Castro believes the numbers are much higher.
We just have just one lab for the whole country to do the PCR.
One lab for the entire country?
Just one lab. Just one.
Since our interview, the government has announced three new labs. But Castro says no data has emerged from any of them. Venezuela is roughly twice the size of California, so getting anything anywhere requires gasoline, which is in short supply thanks to decades-long mismanagement of the country's oil industry, as well as U.S. sanctions. Atop the world's largest oil reserve, people wait in line for hours to fill their tanks. And for the first time, gas, which has always been free, is no longer completely subsidized, adding enormous pressure to a struggling economy where families go through the trash to feed their children. It was conditions like those that forced 5 million people to flee in the last several years. But now the country is facing a new crisis, reverse migration in the middle of a pandemic. 27-year-old Kevin Delgado is one of tens of thousands of Venezuelans who have been forced to return home. He was living in neighboring Colombia when the pandemic hit, and the warehouse he worked in closed down. He says he was out of work for 22 days when he was suddenly evicted. With no other options, he made the painful decision to head back to Venezuela. He and three other friends set out, at first hitchhiking. This is some of his cell phone video. Then 3 days walking through the Paramo, an unforgiving mountainous region that stretches from the tip of the Andes in Peru all the way up to Venezuela.
Psychologically, it was difficult because people have talked about the Paramo, the cold. People have died from hypothermia.
By the time they arrived at the Venezuelan border, there were 500 returnees waiting. They were given rapid COVID tests and then sent to quarantine for 12 days at an abandoned school in a village where they were not welcome.
It took hours because people were blocking the streets and wouldn't let us through. They were saying, they're contaminated. They're going to get us sick.
Maduro has consistently called out returnees for bringing the virus into Venezuela. In this video, he refers to them as bioterrorists. Others have referred to them as fascists, traitors for leaving to seek a better life outside.
In Colombia, they took care of us, but as soon as we got to the Venezuelan side, they didn't even give us water. We only had electricity 4 or 5 hours a day. They put 74 of us in one room, practically on top of each other. I shared my mattress with another person. I knew I was healthy, and the first thing I thought was, they're going to put me with 500 people? I didn't know if they were sick. That was what made me panic.
Kevin says he's grateful it wasn't worse. Claims of no food or water and mistreatment have been rampant, not to mention the fear of infection. This video surfaced of an elderly man begging for his life after being detained for 5 days in a tiny room with no heat and no place to sleep, only broken chairs. Please help us, get us out of here, he cries. We are going to die here.
And they stay there maybe for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks. And they get infected in those places. The people do not have food, do not have water, do not have electricity. They have to deal with the military guys. So the situation there is very concerned in terms of human rights.
So you're saying that they're held there under difficult circumstances and squalid conditions, and then the testing isn't even accurate.
Yeah.
But Dr. Castro did get an accurate test. And after months on the front lines, he tested positive for the virus and is now recovering at home. The new focus on the virus comes as the country remains bitterly divided. Maduro clings to power despite the recognition by the U.S. and dozens of other countries of opposition leader Juan Guaido as the rightful president. We were there back in January when National Guard troops barred Guaido from entering parliament and pro-government vigilantes attacked his car. New parliamentary elections are slated for December, but opposition members have pledged to boycott what they say will be a rigged election. Meanwhile, the Venezuelan people continue to suffer. Kevin finally arrived home and is living with eight other family members in this abandoned building. He's helping his mother by selling meat and cheese to their neighbors. They live day to day. But he says there's no point in trying to save. Hyperinflation means anything put away today could be worth nothing tomorrow.
They buy a little bit every day. Whatever is left over, we eat. It is not something that's going to make us any money, but this is what is left for us.
All that is left for a country where crisis has become a way of life. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Marcia Biggs.
A new memorial will be dedicated in Washington this evening to President Dwight D. Eisenhower, who served as a 34th president and the supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force in Europe during World War II. As Jeffrey Brown reports, the four-acre memorial comes to fruition after 20 years, an internal controversy over its design, and at a time when memorials generally are being re-examined. The story is part of our arts and culture coverage, Canvas.
It's a sprawling tribute to the man known as Ike, Republican president from 1953 to 1961, and five-star general who planned and executed the World War II invasion of Normandy. The memorial is situated in a prime but crowded spot within sight of the nation's capital. Across the street from the Smithsonian Institution's Air and Space Museum and National Museum of the American Indian, directly in front of the U.S. Department of Education. The solution chosen to set it off from that 1961 box-style building, a steel tapestry representing an abstract view of the Normandy cliffs, especially vivid by night. It's based on a drawing by the man who designed the memorial, famed architect Frank Gehry. Gehry, now 91, is renowned for buildings such as the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, Walt Disney Hall in Los Angeles, the New World Center in Miami Beach. But he had never designed a memorial, nor had he designed any structure in Washington, D.C.
My first reaction was, why would I want to go to Washington and get involved with all of that? I realized how impossible that site was to manage because it had traffic. It had three office buildings. You couldn't put something in front of them easily.
But Gehry realized he could play to that environment, nestling a monument to Eisenhower amid government entities that Ike, as president, was responsible for helping bring about. The Department of Education, the Federal Aviation Administration, and what is now known as Health and Human Services.
That became powerful to consider, that here he was being placed in the milieu of his accomplishments, represented by these three office buildings.
But critics, including many in the Eisenhower family itself, were not supportive of the early architectural style, wanting a more traditional approach to what Gehry had in mind. He says they were
trying to derail a modernist view of a memorial in Washington. They thought it should be historicist and classical. I tried to respect classical, actually. The columns are a symbol of government buildings, and so I used them to hold the tapestry.
Gehry's modifications won over the family, including grandson David Eisenhower. An historian who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, he served on the Memorial Commission.
Well, my idea for it, because I think the memorials need to convey something, is that Dwight Eisenhower was a part of a great collective effort in the 1940s, and that is America's effort in World War II. And he was very much a part of that, and he was also typical of the American who had this experience and joined in this great enterprise. His greatest speech, I believe, was probably at the Guildhall on June 12, 1945, where he was accepting the freedom of London. I come from the heart of America.
I come from the very heart of America. And the town where I was reared are far separated from this great city.
The memorial includes a statue of the boy from Abilene by sculptor Sergei Eilenbekov.
Barefoot boy from...
It was those Abilene. Roots that grabbed Gehry as well.
That was powerful for me. And I went to Abilene and saw where he was buried and saw the community he lived in and saw the bedroom he lived in with his other two brothers. It wasn't very big. Very modest. Everything was super, super modest. It was just a lot of things I believed in.
Washington is a city of monuments and memorials, including Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln. More recently, the Vietnam Memorial opened in the 1980s, FDR in the early 90s, World War II in the 2000s, and the Martin Luther King Memorial in 2011. And the building continues. A memorial to Native American veterans is being constructed in the shadow of the Capitol. And a World War I memorial is about to be completed not far away. But the Eisenhower Memorial also opens at a very tense time for the nation, with a very different kind of Republican president and a focus on the history that statues and memorials purport to honor.
I think we're in a completely different moment than when we started. We need to have a pause. We need to take a moment to think about it.
Brown University visiting professor and historian Renee Ader has studied and written on the role of monuments and memorialization.
That's important that he is acknowledged. But we have limited space in this city for monument building, and we need to think about who gets to be in those spaces as we proceed. The monumental sculpture certainly plays into that idea of the great man sculpture. As we start to think about future memorialization efforts, we need to actually more broadly include communities in that discussion about who gets to be in public space, who gets to be represented, and the types of artists that are going to do the representation.
I asked David Eisenhower about these broader and urgent questions of history and memory.
My philosophy is that memorialization is something that reveals us at any given time. And so I think memorialization is a process that is renewed. So when you dedicate a memorial, I think that you are investing or gambling in a sense on the future, that the message that a memorial conveys will have a kind of timeless quality to it.
The opening of this new memorial then offers another chance to consider the nation's larger legacy. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Speaking at the White House conference on American history today, President Trump announced that he would be signing an executive order to create the 1776 Commission, which would promote a, quote, patriotic education. He also blasted efforts to re-examine American history with a deeper emphasis on slavery and racism.
By viewing every issue through the lens of race, they want to impose a new segregation. And we must not allow that to happen. Critical race theory, the 1619 Project, and the crusade against American history is toxic propaganda, ideological poison that, if not removed, will dissolve the civic bonds that tie us together, will destroy our country.
Our White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor joins me now to talk more about this. So, hello, Yamiche. Race, as we know, has been such a charged topic in this country for so much of this year. This isn't the first time the president has addressed race. Give us a little more context about what was behind what the president was saying today.
Well, Judy, as you noted, race has been a topic of conversation in this country for a long time, but especially this year. President Trump, as the 2020 election nears, has made race a core part of his strategy. Critics of the president say that he's made racial division a core part of his strategy. Supporters of the president say that he's made it something of bringing together Americans, while also not calling America racist. Today, what we heard from the president was more of him attacking Americans that are really looking at this country and saying, we need to really understand and the legacy of slavery in a more robust way. The president in particular was making the case without evidence that there is a sort of historical movement afoot to distort American history and to indoctrinate American children and the next generation of Americans with an ideal, a liberal ideal that will benefit Democrats. He said that a lot of these people that he believes are out there are really using America's schools to push forward this idea that America is flawed and that we shouldn't respect our founders and respect historical figures. That, of course, is inaccurate. He took aim specifically at the 1619 Project. This is, of course, a Pulitzer Prize-winning project that was founded and created by Nicole Hannah Jones. She is someone who wants to look at America and say, look, there are founders in our country that we really need to understand in context, pointing out people like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, people, of course, who are American heroes, but who are also owned slaves. And as part of the 1619 Project, what we saw was really a robust telling of all of the different ways that slavery continues to touch our daily lives. And of course, the idea that there were hundreds and thousands of Americans, of Black Americans, who were kidnapped from the continent of Africa and brought to the United States and forced to work, raped and killed and pillaged in order for America to enrich itself and for white Americans in particular to benefit from that. Now, the president today was essentially making the case that this needs to change. He said that he is going to be signing an executive order and it's going to be a national commission on patriotic education. It's not clear exactly what that meant. I've been talking to White House sources who say that the president cares about this, but essentially the 1619 Project is going into American schools, and this based on facts, Judy, not on any sort of exploitation or falsehoods.
So you meet the president also today, as he has before, criticized the protests for racial justice around the country. Give us a sense of what the message was there.
Well, the president was saying that this historical movement to distort American ideals, which again, there is no evidence of this movement, that it has led to the protests that we've seen all over this country. What I know as someone who's covered those protests is that many of these Americans, they're taking to the streets because they want to see America treat African Americans and people of color more fairly. The other thing to note is that Attorney General Bill Barr, in pushing and talking about protesting, he has at one point suggested charging protesters with sedition, which is really a way to really look at them as unlawful, and that has really scared a lot of people, frankly, and see him as politicizing this. The president continues to talk about protesters as if they're domestic terrorists, and Attorney General Bill Barr has also followed suit. I should note today that it's just all kind of in tandem with this campaign strategy of the president.
And in connection with the Attorney General, Yamiche, today, he was speaking about the stay-at-home orders in connection with the pandemic, with COVID, but he tied it to race. Let's listen.
Putting a national lockdown, stay-at-home orders, is like house arrest. It's you know, other than slavery, which was a different kind of restraint, this is the greatest intrusion on civil liberties in American history.
So, Yamiche, how is this being read?
Well, it's being read as tone deaf and as ridiculous. Attorney General Bill Barr saying that stay-at-home orders, which are about people voluntarily staying home to stay safe amid a pandemic, is of course not the same thing at all as slavery and the idea that people were exploited and kidnapped and raped and killed as part of slavery. Jim Clyburn, the second ranking or third ranking, I should say, House Democrat whip, he said that this was tone deaf and god awful. Another thing to note is, though, that this connects with what the people say is the unjust politicizing of the Department of Justice. Attorney General Bill Barr was also having a lot of backlash and getting a lot of backlash for equating prosecutors, rank and file prosecutors, with preschoolers, saying that they should not be in charge ultimately of making a lot of the decisions in particular cases. He's really getting pushback on that. And there are people that are saying this is really alarming that Attorney General Bill Barr is essentially taking the side of President Trump too much and treating the Department of Justice as if they're personal attorneys for the president. Of course, Attorney General Bill Barr has been pushing back on that, but there are a lot of critics out there saying that this is just not right.
Well, a lot to follow today on this subject. Yamiche Alcindor, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed this evening. We thank you. Separately, on the NewsHour online right now, early on in the pandemic, pediatricians could see another crisis looming. That is outbreaks of childhood diseases returning as families withdrew from medical care. We look at the dangers of kids missing their regularly scheduled vaccines. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.